Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
How's everyone doing? Hope you're having a lovely summer. We've had a string of really nice days lately. Of course, they're all nice. We shouldn't have preferences, but they've been not too hot, not too humid, pleasant blue skies. It's been great. Well, today I'm going to talk about the five skandhas, one of the Buddha's basic teachings. This is an important teaching. We know it's important because, for one thing, it's mentioned in the Heart Sutra. The beginning of the Heart Sutra, we have Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva seeing the emptiness of the five skandhas and delivering all beings from their suffering. And there are two points in the Heart Sutra where the five skandhas are mentioned by name, are listed. The five are listed. And we also know it's an important teaching because of when the Buddha taught it, when it occurred during his teaching career. And as many of you know, the Buddha grew up in luxury and upon encountering suffering for the first time became obsessed with the problem of suffering and how to end it and began to look for a way to do that, to end suffering. And he went out into the wilderness and sat for a number of years and became enlightened, which means that he just began to see things really clearly. Mm-hmm. And he found a way to end suffering. And Karen Armstrong, who wrote a wonderful biography of the Buddha called Buddha, reports that after his enlightenment, he was walking down the road. The first person he met was a Jain named Upaka. And Upaka noticed that the Buddha was peaceful and alert, and the Buddha told him he had found supreme enlightenment. And it's reported that Upaka said, "Dream on, friend."
No.
And then he said, "I'm going this way." So that first teaching was not so successful. But he then went on to Varanasi and found the five bhikkhus with whom he had been practicing before he sat down under the Bodhi tree and reached enlightenment. And in his first talk, he explained the Four Noble Truths. And in his second talk, 3 days later, he talked about no self. And it was then that he explained the five skandhas. So it's pretty basic. The five skandhas are form, feeling, perception, formation, and consciousness. This is a way of explaining how suffering works. Understanding suffering allows us to do something about it. It's pretty simple. We see things clearly, we see suffering, we're able to do something about suffering. There's really nothing miraculous or supernatural in that. And it's okay to be open to ideas of magic, the supernatural, things like that. I keep an open mind about those things myself. But no magic or miracle or God is needed for this teaching. Each of us can go inside and look and see what's there. And if we see what's there, we can begin to work with what's there and see things and do things a little differently. So you might say this is more of a psychology or a philosophy than a religion at its core, but it has a lot of the trappings of a religion. And some people are bothered by that, and some people really like that. I really like those trappings myself. When I bow, it helps me to remember the importance of my task, and it helps me to remember and show the respect I have for all beings. But those things aren't really necessary. We could remove all the images and everything, but we won't, because they're helpful for many of us. The Abhidharma, which is the oldest compilation of the Buddha's teaching, is said by Edward Kanzi to be the oldest recorded psychology. So skanda is a Sanskrit word which literally means group or aggregate or heap. So these five things constitute what we normally think of as a personality, some sources say. I find that word personality a little difficult. What I prefer is it's our sense of self. Our sense of self can be broken down into these five things. Sometimes they're called the five factors of individuality. One source, the Introduction to the Middle Length Sutras, says It's a classification scheme that the Buddha devised for demonstrating the composite nature of personality. I think that's a pretty good definition. A classification scheme for demonstrating the composite nature of personality. So like any scheme, this can be really helpful, but it has its limitations, and ultimately the scheme is empty too. So Kanzi explains it using the example of a toothache. Normally we say, I have a toothache. But from the perspective of the five skandhas, we replace the personal expressions with impersonal ones. We divide it, the experience, into form. Form is the tooth, just the tooth as matter. Feeling, which is the pain you feel before you even name the pain, just that sensation, nothing else. Then perception, which is naming it, I have a toothache. And then formations or volitional actions or impulse, which is a feeling that you need to do something about this. Wow, that hurts. I've got to do something. I've got to see a dentist. Or I've got to bear the pain or something. And then finally, consciousness. Consciousness consists of all the comments you make to yourself while you're having the toothache and afterwards, which is all kinds of stories you might make up. You might say, well, I'm going to be really tough. I'm going to tough this out. I'm a really tough person, or I'm a really weak person. I need to do something about this, or this is telling me I need to take better care of myself, and on and on and on. So you're going beyond the immediate experience and making up stories. So I'd like to talk about each of these five skandhas individually. The first one is form. In Sanskrit, it's rupa. This is corporeality or matter. This is stuff, all the stuff we're surrounded with, the world of things. It consists of the sense organs and their objects. To use the language of the Heart Sutra, it's eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind. It's the objects of these organs, visible form, sound, odor, taste, tangible things, etc. By the way, you may have noticed we include mind in there. In Buddhism, we include mind as a sixth sense organ. It's just another way of gathering information about the world. So, as an example of how the five skandhas work, I'd like to tell you about something that happened to me once and try to break it down. And this is something that happened really in an instant or a couple of instants. But it happened to be that I was in kind of a clear place in my mind and I was able to see this. And it really struck me. And the situation was I was driving home from Hokyoji, our retreat center, the retreat center in southeastern Minnesota, after a 7-day retreat, and my mind was really quite clear. And it's always interesting kind of re-emerging into the world after a long retreat at Hokyoji, because everyone is so, by the end, everyone is so in tune there and so respectful of each other and their space, and you probably can't cross near someone without them seeing you coming and really being aware of you and making your path easier. Kind of doing that in all things. And then you get out there on the interstate highway and it's a different story. And it's a little bit of a shock. So what happened was simply that I was driving along and I looked in my rearview mirror and I saw a car very close to my bumper. And that's basically the story. But I can break that down into these skandhas. So first of all, form is simply the car. There's a car there. That's form. Okay. Next comes feeling, which is vedana in Sanskrit, and this is sensations. This includes all sensations, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, experienced through contact of the sense organs and the external world. So feeling is not about these things themselves. It's about our reaction to them. And if we use the example of the car in the rearview mirror, I'm startled. There's this sudden feeling, probably accompanied with a little surge of adrenaline, you know, even though it's a small thing. It's just that immediate experience before it is even given a name. It's just the feeling, and that's all there is. Next comes perception, or samjana, and this includes noticing and naming. It's perception that recognizes something and gives it a name. So, in my case, it's, oh, it's a car. It's a car right there. Giving it a name. And now perception is quite different from those first two skandhas, form and feeling. Form is just there. Feeling is just there. Perception, giving it a name, is our mind adding something to this immediate experience. So as we progress through these skandhas, we are adding more and more with our mind and getting further away with just what's there. So next comes formation or mental formations, samskara, sometimes known as impulse. I like impulse because to me mental formations sounds like the kind of extended thought trips, if you will, that we add to things that comes later in the five skandhas. But impulse is just the basic reaction. One of my friends from Northfield said it's basically animal instinct. It's just reacting. You could imagine the kind of reaction an animal might have if they come across an aggressor or they see some food that they want or something like that. It's just that impulse, just that quick, automatic tendency to take action. So in my case with this car, it's this immediate feeling that I need to avoid an accident, which probably means stepping on the accelerator and getting away from this person. And then finally is consciousness, vijnana. And I did some research on this, and I found that this was difficult. There were a lot of different approaches. It was kind of elusive, and none of them made intuitive sense to me. So I asked Tim, the abbot here, about it, and he gave me a very simple explanation, which really made sense. He said that consciousness comments on and talks about what has been happening in these other four skandhas. So these are the really complex mental processes. And in my example, these are all kinds of things. Planning, I'm going to speed up, or I'm going to slow down and teach this guy a lesson. And that leads to other things like, no, I don't do that anymore. I did that kind of stuff when I was younger, but now I'm a good Buddhist, or am I a good Buddhist? You know, I had that impulse to do that. You know, it just goes on and on and on. And if you meditate much, you're familiar with this. This is the kind of stuff that's going on in our brains all the time when we're trying to settle down. That's consciousness. So I'd like to ask about this little drama that occurs in a split second on the highway. Where is the self in this little drama? Where is the Ted in this drama? And what I'd like to suggest is that there really is no Ted here. There's a car, seeing the car, naming the car, there's reacting to it, and there's making up stories about it. But who's doing all this? Who's doing all this? I would say no one is really doing this. There is no Ted outside or beyond these things. These are only processes with no self behind them or in them or separate from them. So I'd like to explain a little more about this. A really good metaphor, I think, was used by Damien Keane, who says that the five factors make up the self the way an automobile is made up of wheels, transmission, engine, steering, and chassis. Break the automobile down into these parts, and there's nothing we can call an automobile. Break the self down into these parts, and there's nothing we can call a self. Karen Armstrong says, in the Buddha's view, the more closely we examine ourselves, the harder it becomes to find something we can pinpoint as a fixed entity. The human being is not a static being to which things happen. Each person is a process. The Buddha liked to use metaphors such as a blazing fire or a roaring stream to describe the personality. It had some kind of identity, but it was never the same from one moment to another. At each second, a fire is different. It consumes and recreates itself just as people do. And another good passage talking about this, again from the Introduction to the Middle Length Sutras, says, the Buddha teaches, contrary to our most cherished beliefs, that our personality, the five aggregates, cannot be identified as self, as an enduring and substantial ground of personal identity. The notion of self has only a conventional validity, as a convenient shorthand device for denoting a composite, insubstantial situation. It does not signify any ultimate immutable entity subsisting at the core of our being. The bodily and mental factors are transitory phenomena, constantly arising and passing away, processes creating the appearance of selfhood through their causal continuity and interdependent functioning. Nor does the Buddha posit a self outside and beyond the five aggregates. But we try to invent a self. We try to invent a self. Our suffering does not occur because we lack a self. Our suffering occurs because we try to invent a self. And then we're constantly disappointed when that invented self does not work out for us. Kanzi says the insertion of a fictitious self into the actuality of our experience can be recognized whenever I assume that anything is mine, or that I am anything, or that anything is myself. Thus, I have a toothache. Thus, I am disturbed by and the victim of this guy who's driving behind me. I feel that there is some me that exists beyond all of these personal, beyond all of these impersonal forces. So wanting to hold on to this invented me causes attachment or grasping or clinging. We desire to protect the personality from threats to its integrity. So I keep trying to convince myself that there is a self here that has certain attributes. And threats to that self-image can disturb me. So I fight a little harder to preserve that self-image. And it doesn't quite work out, and it breaks down a little bit, and it causes suffering. Rather than kind of letting go and saying, well, I'm a process here, and there's no core. I'm a process, and things keep changing, and that's okay, and I'm going to kind of go with these. I'm going to let these happen, and I'm going to wake up, and I'm going to say, ask, who am I today? Well, I don't know. We will find out. Attachments, the attachments I was talking about, also have corresponding fears. If you're attached to something, you fear losing it. If you're attached to the self, you fear losing it. So you fight hard to kind of preserve your identity, whatever identity you've found. And another passage from this introduction here, a short one. The Buddha's statement that the five aggregates are dukkha, or suffering, the Buddha said that the five aggregates are suffering, reveals that the very things we identify with and hold to as the basis for happiness, rightly seen, are the basis for the suffering that we dread. Even when we feel ourselves comfortable and secure, the instability of the aggregates is itself a source of oppression and keeps us perpetually exposed to suffering. That's pretty grim. That's pretty harsh. The harsh suffering, or the harsh truth. But so the big question is, I mean, if we accept this harsh truth, is what do we do with this knowledge? How do we live in a world which is basically insecure? Well, what we do with this knowledge, if we look at the five skandhas and we see how things are, we take the invented self out of it. We learn to remove that illusion of self to which we cling. And then it's much easier to accept things as they are and not be chasing after something that we have invented. And that's what we do here at Zen Center. We come here and we try to find enough quiet that we can see these things and how they work and let go of our own self-centered view, get beyond that view, see the five skandhas, see how things are, see thusness rather than how we want things to be. And if you're new to this practice, this may sound a little scary that we are taking the self out of it. learning to take the self out of it, learning to see how the self is not really there. You might imagine that you will adopt this practice and become kind of a blank sort of person without a self, and you will be uninteresting and not have a personality. And that's really not the case at all, because people I know who have gone really far down this path are the most interesting and exciting people. You know, they are not blank. They don't lose their juiciness, as Pema Chodron says. She likes to use that phrase. If anything, they become more juicy. They have these qualities that make you want to know them, that make you want to hang out with them. And besides, Buddhists know that that juicy self is part of the deal. It's part of the deal, because samsara and nirvana are the same. Nirvana is not something separate from what we have here. It's just this right here. And it includes your ridiculous old self, which you're going to keep dragging around, and it's going to keep entertaining you for some time. You're going to see it a little more clearly, you know, and you're going to step back from it. It's still going to be there. So, but hopefully we spend more time in the first and second skandhas, those immediate skandhas. We're on the cushion, we find a really quiet place, and there is form, and there is feeling, and there's just what's there. It's just right in front of us, in all of its vividness, without the stuff we add to it. Now, do you ever do a sitting or two here, and you walk outside, and you see the lake, and you see the trees, and they just hit you with this incredible vividness? There they are. That's it. That's it. You're in those first two skandhas. You're not adding anything to your experience. So we're taking the self out of it. Or more accurately, we're stepping back, seeing the self, seeing what this illusion of self is, and learning to be in a world where that's apparent. So how do we do this? First, we can understand all of this intellectually, which is helpful, but this is not the best, because we need to really feel this in our bones. The second is we can be mindful of these things in meditation. The rearview mirror example, the car in the rearview mirror, that's exactly what happens in meditation. These things come up all the time. Whatever it is that comes up, you may have a pain in your knee. There's your knee, there's the pain, there's that sudden feeling, then you give it a name, then you start adding more and more things to it, and pretty soon you're really thinking about your knee. But maybe next time you're a little quieter, you've been sitting a little longer or something, and it's just your knee, and it's just the pain, and you experience it, you feel it, and you don't add that stuff. And it just goes away. And okay, you're just sitting, and then something else comes up. You hear a motorcycle going by. And this time you don't wonder where it's going or whether it's going to disturb your peace of mind. You just let it go. It arises and it falls away. So we often follow our breath in meditation. We do various disciplines that help us to become disciplined, but sometimes we reach the point where we just kind of drop all that and we just sit and things arise and they fall away. And that's called shikantaza. Another way that we do this is practicing mindfulness in daily life. We simply pay very close attention to what's going on, what we're doing. Moment after moment, we're just right there with it, and we try not to add to it. And the Buddha gave instructions as to how to do this. Which I'll simply read. Herein, monks, a monk thinks, thus is material form, thus is the arising of material form, and thus is the disappearance of material form. Thus is feeling, thus is the arising of feeling, thus is the disappearance of feeling. Thus is perception, thus is the arising of perception, thus is the disappearance of perception. Thus are formations, thus is the arising of formations, and thus is the disappearance of formations. Thus is consciousness, thus is the arising of consciousness, and thus is the disappearance of consciousness. I really like that. You notice that it's very repetitious. And one reason for that is I think the repetition helped people to memorize things in a day when nothing was written down. But also, even though it's repetition, it kind of mimics what happens in our minds. Things arise, things fall away. Things arise, things fall away. So it's not so much in, you know, the meaning of the words that he's speaking to us. It's with the rhythm of how things come up and how things fall away. So we have many ways of working on this. We have meditation and mindfulness in daily life are very important. Having encouragement of others, having sangha is very important. Coming to Zen Center or another center is a very helpful thing because these things are kind of hard to do alone. And we pursue all this with a great deal of kindness and a great deal of forgiveness because getting down on ourselves and saying we're doing really badly is not going to help at all. Great deal of kindness, great deal of forgiveness. The same kindness we would extend to anyone else who is struggling and adopting this practice. We extend that to ourselves as well. So, and what's the result of all this? We don't talk too much about results here at Zen Center because if you're looking for a result, it can distract you from the practice. And you can't really be in this moment if you're looking ahead for a result. But still, I don't know, I like to sneak it in. You know, we need a little incentive, so just bear with me here. What we do is we find our true self, as our teacher Tim Burkett says. We find our true self. That's identity with the absolute. That's beyond the invented self. Sri Aurobindo said, once we are quiet, once we take the self out of it, thoughts and activities cross the mind as a flight of birds crosses the sky in a windless air. It passes, disturbs nothing, leaving no trace. Karen Armstrong says that the Buddha tried to make his bhikkhus see that they did not have a self that needed to be defended, inflated, flattered, cajoled, and enhanced at the expense of others. Do you ever feel like you're flattering, cajoling, and enhancing your invented self? Doesn't that get tiresome? Once a monk had become practiced in mindfulness, he or she would no longer interject his ego into these passing mental states and identify with them. He would learn to regard desires, fears, and cravings as remote phenomena that had little to do with him. And Buddhaghosa, who lived in the 4th century in India and Sri Lanka, put it this way. Mere suffering exists, but no sufferer is found. The deeds are, but no doer is found. Mere suffering exists, but no sufferer is found. Note that it's not, I cannot find a sufferer, or we cannot find a sufferer. It's not from the perspective of any self. It's beyond self. They say that good writing doesn't use the passive tense very much, but we Buddhists use the passive tense a lot. It's not, I gave a talk today. It's, a talk was given today. I wrote a little haiku that I attempted to express this with, and it is, the wind howls around the house where no one lives. The wind howls around the house where no one lives. So I've used examples, painful knee, car in the rearview mirror of the 5 skandhas, which both involve unpleasant feelings. But the 5 skandhas apply to pleasant feelings as well. And I'd like to give you another example of that. So starting with form, there were these white lines on a tan background. White lines with a little hook at the end. So it actually looked like a series of white check marks laying on their sides on a tan background. That's the form. The feeling is it's a pleasant feeling. It's a pleasant feeling. Something about these white lines on a tan background is very pleasant. I think it's just aesthetically pleasing. And then after that comes perception. Perception is me. I happen to be driving in my car again after meditation. Perception is me saying, oh, that's snow on gravel. And then comes formation or volitional action. That's me wanting to continue to look and wanting to look for more cool things because I'm seeing something which gives me a pleasant feeling. And then finally comes consciousness, which is all the stories we add to this. And part of consciousness is seeing what's really going on here. I'm driving, this was in the winter time, end of winter, and I was driving south on I-35 where there was all that construction. And there was a huge pile of gravel by the side of the road and caterpillar tracks because a caterpillar had shaped this gravel and climbed up and left these tracks. And the snow had all melted away except for a little bit in each track. So it made these beautiful little lines. So they're seeing all of that, kind of realizing what it is and kind of thinking, well, that's really interesting. That's really cool the way that happened. You know, that's consciousness. And then more adding to it about how it's so nice after you sit. You see these things and they just kind of jump at you and it's so pleasant. I'd like to do more of that. And then realizing, oh, no, but if I look for it, then I'm not going to find it. You know, that's the conundrum. And kind of the ultimate conscience, if you're a consciousness, if you're a Zen teacher, is saying, I can use this in a talk. So, you know who is really good at this, at really kind of staying in those first two skandhas and expressing what was there without adding too much to it? Was the poet William Carlos Williams, who one of his more famous poems is, so much depends upon our bread wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens. I love that. It's just there. That is one red wheelbarrow. So much depends upon a red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens. Another one he wrote. Some leaves hang late, some fall before the first frost. So goes the tale of winter branches and old bones. Some leaves hang late, some fall before the first frost. So goes the tale of winter branches and old bones. This is called Nantucket. Flowers through the window, lavender and yellow, changed by white curtains, smell of cleanliness, sunshine of late afternoon on the glass tray, a glass pitcher, the tumbler turned down by which a key is lying, and the immaculate white bed. This is just to say, is the title. I have eaten the plums that were in the icebox and which you were probably saving for breakfast. Forgive me, they were delicious, so sweet and so cold. Maybe a little bit added there, but still, that moment is right there. And this one is called The Great Figure. Among the rain and lights, I saw the figure five in gold on a red fire truck moving, tense, unheeded, to gong clangs, siren howls, and wheels rumbling through the dark city. I'll read that one again. I love that. Among the rain and lights, I saw the figure five in gold on a red fire truck moving, tense, unheeded, to gong clangs, siren howls, and wheels rumbling through the dark city. And a painter named Charles DeMuth, made a painting from this poem, which does the same thing visually. It's just five. I'll pass this around because this is really tiny. It's just five. It's just the number five. Nothing else. So this is what we do. This is our practice. We look at what's there and we see it. And it comes at us. And I may risk losing any credibility I've built up here because I'm talking a little bit from the the perspective of the clinging self here, but seeing this stuff in this way is fine, and it can make us happy. And this happiness, we can see it in the literature. Walpola Rahula reports that the king of Kosala once told the Buddha that unlike many a disciple of other religious systems who looked haggard, coarse, pale, emaciated, and unprepossessing, the Buddha's disciples were joyful and elated, jubilant and exultant, enjoying the spiritual life with faculties pleased, free from anxiety, serene, peaceful, and living with a gazelle's mind, i.e., lighthearted.
I kind of thought you looked like a gazelle.
Yeah, okay. Oh, and remember the five bhikkhus that the Buddha met and gave his first two sermons to? Karen Armstrong reports that it was when they heard the Buddha explaining no self that all five bhikkhus attained their full enlightenment and became arahants. The texts tell us that this teaching filled their hearts with joy. So we can do this, you know, we can do this. We can do this practice. But we need to sit. There's no way around it. You really need to sit. You need to have a regular meditation practice. And you need to come to the center or a center or hang out with people who are doing this. You need Sangha because these things are so subtle. We need to keep ourselves inspired. We need to keep coming back. And having good friends on the same path is the best way to do this. So just give this a try. Keep coming back. Keep coming back to those first and second skandhas, that place where things happen before thought, before you add experience. Keep coming back there. So, please give this a try. So, thank you. So, we have time for a couple of questions. Will?
If I have a friend who has a bad self, am I enabling them in the delusion of self if I tell them things about their past and why they're really a good person, why they really are successful, or no?
No, I think that's a kind thing to do, don't you?
That was my instinct.
Yeah, I remember a good friend. Oh, sure. Thank you, Cindy. The question was, if I can repeat it, is... if I have a friend and I keep telling this friend that, no, you are a good person and no, you've done wonderful things in the past, am I helping this person or am I sort of enabling them to have this illusory self? And I think it's a kind thing to do. And I have a good friend who once said, I would like to get an ego before I lose my ego. And there's something to be said for that, too. You know, and in a way, you know, we need a strong ego, too. We need to be able to function in the world, you know. And there's kind of the relative and absolute ways of looking at this. But we all need to kind of have self-confidence and be able to do things in the world and be really strong. We need to work on that stuff too. But at the same time, we need to see that, you know, and what goes into that. But I think, you know, building each other up in this way is also very important. So. Yes?
Mm-hmm. Back from that joyfulness of a relationship. I mean, why would you do that?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think you would. I think you yeah, thank you. Keep reminding me. The question is, you know, could you explain the five skandhas in terms of interpersonal relationships? And would you step back from the pleasure here? And why would you want to do that? Why would you want to step back from the joyfulness of a relationship? And I don't think you would. I think you would want to, you want to feel that joy. You want to share that joy. Of course you do. But the thing is to kind of, to see the joy for what it is and see when it's genuinely there and it really is joy in sort of delighting in another person. That's just kind of this immediate thing that we can enjoy. But sometimes in our interpersonal relationships, we add things and things get pretty complicated. We like the joy so much, we want to hang on to it. We want the other person to cooperate. So we start trying to get them to do things our way so this thing can keep going. And then we're kind of adding. And that's the stuff we need to see and kind of work on. And the more we can go back to that initial joy, you know, there's the relationship, there's the feeling that's just there. It's just delighting in another person. That's like kind of like the first and second skandhas. The more we can come back to that, the better off we are. If we get caught in that consciousness and spend too much time there, that's what we need to step away from. Does that answer your question? Okay, good.
Mm-hmm. Where's the part of the old Ted might have put on the brakes. Where's that old habit energy fall into the
Okay, I'm glad I can repeat this because it'll give me a chance to think about it. In the example of the car in the rearview mirror, that old habit energy, in the old days I would have put my foot on the brake to teach this guy a lesson. Where does this fit into the analysis of the five skandhas? I just think of it as being part of consciousness, just, you know, one of those stories. It's analysis, you know. I love to analyze things and try to, my brain loves to analyze things and try to draw general principles from specific events, you know. And part of that is thinking about how I reacted to things in the past, how I react to things now. Kind of gives me an opportunity to form this sort of structure, this thought structure about how I might be changing, things like that.
What about when you were back in the day when you would just do that?
Back in the day when I would just do that.
Yeah. And it was a habit that you would just do every time.
That,
thinking about it.
Yeah, well, that's probably consciousness telling me to teach this person a lesson. But then again, it's pretty close to that instinct, volitional action, too. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like not having too much restraint and just kind of going with your instinct. You know, my instinct was, well, I guess, anger. Anger would be involved here. Who does this guy think he is? I'm going to show him, you know. So maybe it's volitional action that we're looking at here.
I think it's just, as you were talking about this, it reminded me of some of the studies of neuroscience that they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And that what happens if you repeat something over and over again, it basically creates a pathway in the brain so that a conscious act, you know, a conscious storyline, if it's repeated enough, then it becomes a habit. So it becomes an impulse because it's that path is traveled so much.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like it goes from consciousness into impulse.
Yeah. Okay. For you, if anyone, for you listening to the CD, Monica has just rescued me here by answering Rosemary's question much better than I did by saying that research indicates that if we repeat things often enough, it becomes kind of ingrained, and that if we repeat things enough, if our consciousness causes us to repeat things enough, it can really become volitional action. Really, it goes from consciousness back to volitional action. That's Monica said it more eloquently, but this will have to do. Any more questions? Okay. Well, before I finish, I'd like to make a little plug for the teen group we're doing this fall that I'll be doing along with several other people. It's going to meet here on Thursday nights, 10 different Thursdays, and it's going to be for any kids ages 13 to 19 who are interested in Buddhism. And I think it's going to be really fun. And I think if we can get kids in the door, they're going to enjoy it and they'll keep coming back. But getting them in the door is the hard part. So if you know of any teenagers who might be interested, or if you have teenagers who might be interested, please let them know. And I don't really believe in forcing kids to do this kind of thing. That's why I encourage bribery. That's what I use. I once bought my son a new guitar to get him to stay at Hokyoji one more day. So I know how this works. And hopefully it won't be that expensive for you, but see what you can do. So, yes?
Teenagers, including 18 and 19, you know, college age, or are you looking at high school?
We're saying all teenagers, 13 to 19. We don't know what ages will show up. It's a pretty broad range. But, yeah, I think, first-year college students, that would be okay. So, all right. Thank you very much.